we have held conferences and seminars and workshops and lectures just like this one. We have welcomed college and seminary students for class sessions at the center, for show and tell sessions on the Reformation and early printing using our rare book collection. We have provided financial assistance for research fellowships to over 120 scholars over the past 30 years, from places around the world, including the United States, South Korea, Indonesia, South Africa, Ghana, Argentina, Brazil, Canada, and almost every country in Europe, including some scholars from Geneva who have come to Grand Rapids to do research on Calvin and the Reformation. We're celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Meter Center with a range of events. We have this lecture tonight, and then tomorrow we are holding an open house here in the Meter Center from 9 to noon. There's a special chapel service at 10 a.m. in the seminary. And if you like singing Genevan Psalms, that's the one to come to, because that's what we'll be doing. And we're also having a presentation here on the Meter Center's rare book collection and its medals collection starting at 10:45. So if you have time tomorrow morning, you want to come by, you're most welcome to do that. In the afternoon, we will be welcoming some 30 faculty members from Michigan and Illinois who are coming here for an invitational symposium on the present state and future directions of Reformation studies. And tonight, we will be hearing from Dr. Karen Spierling. She is Associate Professor of History at Denison University in Ohio. Dr. Spierling is no stranger to the center. She received a fellowship from the Meter Center in 1999. She has been a regular participant in our Calvin Studies Society meetings that happen every 2 years that have been hosted by the Meter Center here in Grand Rapids on several occasions. Dr. Spierling obtained her bachelor's degree from Yale University and her master's and PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her thesis director was the late Professor Robert Kingdon, another dear friend and benefactor of the Meter Center. Dr. Spierling is the author of Infant Baptism in Reformation Geneva, The Shaping of a Community, 1536 to 1564, first published by Ashgate in 2005, and reissued by Westminster John Knox Press in 2009. In 2008, she co-edited a volume of essays with Michael Halverson titled Defining Community in Early Modern Europe. And she's currently working on research on ongoing relations between Catholics and Protestants in post-Reformation Geneva. Her lecture for us this evening is In Pursuit of Godliness, The Challenges of Reform in 16th Century Geneva. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Karen Spierling.
Thank you very much. I will try to stay here and speak into the microphone. I have a tendency to wander. Usually my lecture voice is enough to accommodate that, but feel welcome to raise your hand if you can't hear me. First, I want to say thank you so very much. Thank you to Corrine for the invitation to be here and be part of the 30th anniversary celebration. Thank you to the board of the Meter Center and the friends of the Meter Center. This is, as Corrine was giving you some indication of, although she wouldn't brag, this is an incredible resource for scholars of Calvin, Calvinism, Geneva. My advisor Robert Kingdon was a big fan of the Meter Center, very devoted, and would have really loved to be here for a celebration like the 30th anniversary. I think this is one of a list of things that he would have been sorry to miss in recent years. So I'm glad that I can be here with all of you. And as Corrine was mentioning, the Meter Center provides a wealth of texts and sources that scholars come from all over the place to look at. And as I was thinking about that and thinking about coming back to the Meter Center, I haven't been here for a few years, I was thinking that you can get so absorbed. There's so many texts, right, about Calvin and about Geneva, but especially about Calvin and Calvinists and Calvin's writings and people writing about Calvin and people writing about the people who wrote about Calvin, that it is possible, I won't say easy, but it is possible to disconnect Calvin from Geneva, and to sort of leave his Genevan context behind. And as a specialist on the history of the Reformation, and specifically the Reformation in Geneva, I personally think that it's critical to think about the context of Geneva. But I also professionally think that we lose a lot as we try to look back through the layers of almost 500 years of different scholars and different denominations and different people who want to claim or revile Calvin, depending on the circumstances. It's easy to lose track of what lies at the end, behind all of those layers, or really at the beginning, which is the context of Geneva and the work that Calvin was doing there. And the fact that everything that is, all of the ideas that we take now that we can look at as sort of written on the page and the absolute final word of Calvin, were in a constant process of formation and negotiation and frustration sometimes, back in the mid-1500s. So what I would like to do to begin, I'm going to talk to you tonight about a few of the challenges that Calvin and the consistory faced in trying to implement the Reformation in Geneva. But what I would like to do to start that is to situate us in Geneva with images. I'm not a big bullet point person, so we don't have bullet points tonight, but I have some images and maps to take us, to focus us on Calvin's context. This first image obviously is not from the 16th century, but for those of you who have traveled to Geneva, you may recognize that this mountain here is the Salève. It's just outside of Geneva, and very importantly, it is in France. What I want us to remember, number one, as we begin tonight, is that Geneva was surrounded by Catholics almost entirely, right? When Calvin is working there, starting in the 1530s. Even today, the border to France is this close. So we always, it's important, I think, to keep in mind that proximity, that Catholicism is not just sort of something that is happening in Rome or something far away, but Catholicism in 16th century Geneva is neighbors and family and business partners, and less than a day's ride away, right? It's often the home of servants who come to work in Geneva. So right down here, we have the old city of Geneva. There's the Jet d'Eau, which wasn't there then. But this close would have been Catholicism, even at that same time. Let me show you a map. All right, here to give you the map schematic, we have Geneva all the way down here in the corner, just as it is today in Switzerland. In the mid-1500s, we don't yet have the fully formed state of Switzerland as we think of it today. But again, to keep, I know this is hard for some of you to see, but there's this little tip down here of Geneva, which is just recently independent when Calvin is there. And then in this direction, we would have had the Duchy of Savoy, a Catholic power. In this direction, we would have had the Franche-Comté under the rule of France. And just a little further, we have the full power of the French monarchy itself. All Catholic powers interested in bringing Geneva back under the political control of a Catholic power and back into the Catholic realm, religiously speaking. And then, whoops, oh.
Yeah, that happened.
I gave away the next picture. Yeah. All right. And then the third thing that I want to remind you all of is the general political and religious context of the mid-1500s, which is second nature to those of us and those of you who studied the Reformation period, but maybe a little bit further back in your college years for those of you who aren't specialists. So here again, we have a Swiss Confederation. Geneva is right down here in the corner. We have France, Savoy, the Franche-Comté, and then here we have, and this looks like maybe it was folded a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit squished. the Holy Roman Empire, right, where in the 1530s and 1540s we have a civil war breaking out between the Catholic Holy Roman Emperor, who is on a mission to re-Catholicize his empire, and various Protestant princes and cities who are on a mission to protect their Protestantism and some of their political rights as well. So close in to Geneva and sort of further out in the geographical and political picture, this is a very complicated time. And Calvin is working in all of those contexts, right? Geneva is recently independent as of 1536. It is quite anxious to remain independent. It is reliant for its independence on the support of Bern, a large Protestant canton with a powerful military, and much closer to it, right, Geneva is faced with these various Catholic powers. So Calvin, in a way, this new independence is an advantage for Calvin. Once he comes back in 1541, the Genevan City Council is very anxious that the church should succeed to help shore up the stability of the city. On the other hand, it is a city with a lot of ongoing contact with Catholics, living in an era where there is always, very literally, the threat of being retaken by Catholicism. So it is important to keep all of those contexts in mind. At the same time, we have the vision of Calvin, right? The idea that Calvin comes back in 1541, that he literally lays down the law. Here are the ecclesiastical ordinances. This is the way things will be done. People will always come to church. They will never be too late to hear a sermon. They will never leave before the sermon is over, right? They will never get drunk, although they may imbibe alcohol, which somehow got lost in the haze of history. But they will never get drunk. They will never have a conflict with their neighbor, right? They will follow this strict set of rules. If you just look at the rules and assume that they were put into practice exactly as they were written, then you get the stereotype of Geneva as the sort of perfect reformed society, where Calvin is in control and the church has authority throughout society and people come to church on a regular basis. And you end up with, I love this particular shot of the wall, right? This image of Calvin written in stone, looming over Geneva. That's a nice picture, I guess. It always strikes me when I visit that wall in Geneva that Calvin himself, of course, would have been horrified, right? This was part of an anniversary celebration in the early 1900s to build this wall. And for Calvin never would have signed off on this enormous statue of him looming over the city. But I think it's a very good symbol of sort of the picture that many people still have. If you Google Calvin, if you spend your time Googling Calvin, you can find plenty of positive websites that say, you know, Calvin laid it all out and did it right, and we just have to figure out how to do it right again. And then you can find all these other websites that say Calvin was a tyrant, he had total control over Geneva, and that was terrible, and that should never happen again. But either way, it's this very sort of absolute picture of Calvin. And in fact, when Calvin comes back to Geneva in 1541, he spends the rest of his life pursuing his ideal. So what I want to talk about tonight is a little bit about what that ideal was in terms of the operation of the consistory, and then some examples of obstacles and hurdles that the consistory runs into as it's trying to do its work. So when Calvin comes back in 1541, the city council agrees he can form this consistory, basically a morals court, 12 pastors, 12 elders, depending on the number of pastors in the city at the time. In order for the consistory to do its work, it depends upon the population of Geneva to provide it truthful information, right? It relies on neighbors to tell the truth about what they know about their neighbors. It relies on family members to tell the truth about what they know about their family members. And this is not a surprise, but it, again, can get lost in that haze of history. Many people had different standards than Calvin did for when truth needed to be told, right? And when absolute truth was necessary and when a little bit less truth was necessary. And this is a serious and critical issue for Calvin, right? So for Calvin, as you read his Institutes and read through his commentaries and his sermons, his vision of the ideal Christian society is one in which faithful Christians are serving God in their daily lives through self-denial, right, and self-renunciation, as he talks about in the Institutes. That you put God first, and a way that you demonstrate that is by taking care of those around you. In the interest of taking care of those around you, you tell the truth. And there have been different ways that this has been addressed in scholarship. Mark Valeri, for example, has wrote an article about the importance of truth in economic transactions for Calvin, and how there are ways that Calvin is really not the proto-capitalist that we think of him as, because he was much more focused on transparency in economic transactions to protect the community. The consistory is about, or partly about, I guess at the beginning, it is largely about making sure that people know the Lord's Prayer and the basic tenets of the Reformed faith. But it is also about serving as an aid, right, to the depraved and sinful Christians who need the aid of God to serve God in their daily lives. So for Calvin, his vision is not that the society will ever be perfect, right? That's not for this world, but that the consistory needs to help people create a well-ordered society that takes care of other people. For Calvin, as I see it in the consistory records, as he operates in Geneva, one of his top priorities, right, is trying to lead and teach people to put God and the community first. And one of the issues that comes up with the consistory is that even people who are willing to go to church, even people who are willing to convert from Catholicism, even people who have no problem having their children baptized Protestant instead of Catholic, do not always automatically or easily put God and the community first, number one all the time, right? They have competing obligations. They have work obligations. They have family obligations. They have social networks. And those different networks can get in the way or can affect the way that people decide when they need to tell the truth and how they need to tell that truth. For Calvin, sorry, I keep having this impulse to stop and ask for questions, which is what I do with my students, but we'll save the questions till the end. I think that's enough of the looming Calvin. Here we go. All right. One more point about Calvin's idea about truth, and then I'll give you some examples from the consistory. One of the many places that we can see Calvin's ideas, emphasis on the importance of truth-telling, aside from the Institutes and commentaries, one very good place to look at the connection between Calvin's ideas and practices is the Catechism. Everyone in Geneva was expected to attend Catechism services until they were, notice I said expected, but they were expected to attend catechism services until they could say the statement of faith and the Lord's Prayer and had learned the Ten Commandments in French, not in Latin. The ninth commandment is that here in English, the commandment that thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. And in the explication down here, or Calvin has the questions and then the catechism student answering them. I want to emphasize this section here. We shall not by falsehood calumniate our neighbor, nor by our evil speaking and detraction destroy his reputation or bring any damage to him in his estate. Here we are talking about truth as a way to safeguard the reputation of the community in general, individuals as part of a community. If we skip down to here, what is the sum of this commandment? It forbids us to think evil of our neighbors and to indulge any propensity to defame them. And on the other hand, God commands us to be endowed with equity and humanity, that we may be studious to think well of them as far as the truth will permit, and to preserve our estimation of them entire, as far as the truth will permit, no farther than that, right? Think well of your neighbors as far as the truth will permit. Do not come to the consistory and lie to us to protect your neighbor's reputation. And I think there are a couple of things that are important about the catechism when we're thinking about the consistory. First of all, the consistory would have expected that people who couldn't prove that they understood, that they had memorized at least, these different prayers and the commandments would have been ordered basically to go to catechism. That included children. It also included servants. It also always included a sermon. So it was not just sort of the Sunday school that you might think of, but there's always a sermon. So for the consistory, this is a sort of baseline expectation that people would understand the ninth commandment in this way. The second thing that I want to point out about this particular way that Calvin emphasizes thinking well of your neighbors is that this comes into direct tension with the way that some people approach the consistory and see their own obligations, right? For Calvin, the most important thing is the good of the community, the good of the Christian community, living in service to God. For some people who come before the consistory, the most important thing is protecting their family reputation, right? Or making sure that other people think well of their family even further than the truth permits, not only as far as the truth permits. So one thing that we see in the consistory records is that the consistory is constantly, or at least frequently concerned that people are lying to them. They frequently chastise people that they, are you sure you're telling the truth? You need to be telling the truth. And yet at the same time, for the consistory to function, right, but similar to other court systems, they have to function with the information that they can obtain, recognizing that they have not always obtained the full truth. So one thing that I want to set out there tonight is this idea that that ideal Geneva, even by the time we get to Calvin's death, the ideal Geneva does not exist in reality. And it is a constant process, right, of trying to teach people and improve people and improve the community. And there are always people in Geneva, again, even if they consider themselves good church members, who sometimes choose other priorities. Two good examples of types of cases where people choose other priorities. One is the case of people who have Catholic connections outside of Geneva. And a second example is a case of servants who were often important sources of information for the consistory and who might get caught between the consistory's expectation of truth-telling and their employer's expectation of protecting the family's honor. So let me talk to you a little bit about some of those examples and see what my... All right, so of course, right, being Calvin's Geneva, there's not a lot of artwork, a lot of paintings of consistory meetings or daily life in Geneva. So you can contemplate the map of Geneva in the 16th century. while I tell you a little bit about some examples of these different types of reasons that people might challenge the consistory outright or evade the consistory or simply act on different standards than the consistory has. So, as I said, one example is a case of people who maintained connections to Catholic family members, to Catholic business ties, and moved in and out of the city. Or, sometimes they had Catholic servants. One very famous, now I'm also, I also have the impulse to write on a chalkboard. One family that I have written about that had a lot of Catholic connections was a family called the Lulins. And something that's interesting about the Lulin family is that they were very involved in the Genevan government. There were members of the Lulin family on the consistory. Some of them were political opponents of Calvin. Some of them were supporters of Calvin. They're sort of all over the place, politically speaking. But the reason that they appear before the consistory in the 1540s and 1550s often has to do with Catholic ties. For example, at least two different points, there are cases where they have servants who are in trouble for having fathered illegitimate children. And in one of those cases, the consistory repeatedly demands that the current head of the household in the Lulin family bring the servant to the consistory. It is his responsibility as the head of the household to bring the servant to the consistory and make sure that this servant answers the questions about his behavior, and if he has in fact committed fornication, that he be sent on to the city council. The Lulin family never follows through. That servant disappears into Catholic territories, and the consistory is never able to sort of bring him to consistorial justice. The very same family, in a later case in 1558, the same head of the household, who is a brother, is called again for more issues involving servants, and then the consistory says, oh, and by the way, we heard that you have sisters in Catholic territories. Is your sister hanging out with Catholics? And he sort of said, oh, well, I'm not sure. I'll have to check on that for you. And then he says, yes, my older sister and her husband are traveling with my younger sister. And the consistory says, well, bring them back right now. Bring your younger sister back here right now. And what comes out of that is that eventually he comes back to the consistory and he says, I couldn't get her back. I did what I could. You know, I wrote them a letter, but there's nothing I can do. She's not coming back. That's the kind of case where I certainly can't tell from the records if he's lying outright. And the consistory couldn't know for sure, right? The consistory doesn't say, we don't believe you. But the consistory is sort of caught. There is nothing they can do at that point except accept his word that, in fact, he did try to get his sister to come back. Once she comes back, then she gets called before the consistory. The older sister, during this whole sojourn, the older sister has a baby in the city of Lyon, which was not entirely Catholic, but partly Catholic at this time. Geneva finds out about it. The consistory finds out when they come back to Geneva. They have a baby. Baby's been baptized. They weren't in Geneva. They find out the baby's been baptized Catholic. And they call the mother. Her name was Pernette. In 1561, they call Pernette to the consistory and they say, we heard that you had a baby in a Catholic territory and that you had the baby baptized Catholic. And Pernette says, oh, I don't know anything about it. I was too sick, which could be true. Mothers aren't usually expected to be at the baptism, right? She says, I was too sick from childbirth. It was out of my hands. I had no control over what was happening. And the consistory, again, right? This is just one person's word against someone else's. They don't have the proof to say, you are lying to us. And instead what they do is they say, Do you really think that this is what a good mother does? Is this the work of a bon mère? Like, have you really done allowing your child to be while you thought you were dying on your child bed, allowing your child to be taken away? Is that how a good mother would act? They're not going to undo the baptism. That was not part of the Reformed practice. They have no authority to go and yell at or chastise the Catholic priest who baptized the baby, right? The Lulin family at this point is well established economically that they don't want to chase them out of Geneva. But ultimately, right, they're sort of helpless in that situation. They don't know the truth for sure.
Yes.
They call in the father also, who is not a Genevan citizen. He is German, so she's married to a foreigner. Ultimately, there is not that much that they can do without knowing the story for sure, right? So when things happen inside Geneva, they have a lot more eyewitnesses. When things happen outside of Geneva, it's a lot harder to gather the information. One other example of Catholics, and then I'll talk for a moment about servants. Another thing that happens with that baptism case, we see people traveling back and forth from Geneva to Catholic territories. There's another case in 1558 of a young man who leaves Geneva. He's from France originally, so he's an immigrant, which is increasingly an issue in Geneva in the 1550s. He has come to Geneva, he has converted, he has become part of the Reformed Church, and then he travels back to France. And then he comes back to Geneva, and he gets called to the consistory because he comes to the consistory. That's what's unusual in this case. He comes to the consistory to tell them that he attended Catholic Mass. Not unusual that he attended Catholic Mass. Very unusual that he comes to the consistory and confesses this to them freely. And so in this case, what happens? Here we have someone who volunteers this information. He comes and he tells them, I abjured the Reformed faith. I made a mistake. I have come back to Geneva. I want to come back to the Reformed Church. Will you, please readmit me? And at this point, just recently, there's been a spate in the late 1550s of people moving back and forth. The consistory has gotten very frustrated. They've asked the city council, they have said, please put some order to the problem of, quote, those who renounce the gospel and the pure doctrine that they know to be for our salvation. And after having been in the popery in Catholic lands, then return here. And what the city council had done in response, they had said, when such renouncers come and return themselves to the church, they should similarly repair their fault before the church in order to give an example to the others. A public admission of fault is what the consistory wants and the city council grants. The idea with that legislation is that people are going to come back to Geneva and the consistory will somehow find out they had gone to Mass, right? And that they need to be sort of publicly shamed for having done that. It's about 6 months later that this young man has come back and admitted, I went to Mass, I abjured the Reformed faith, and now I'm coming back. And the consistory's conclusion in this case, they say, because there is an edict, which we asked for, because there is an edict regarding those who renounce God like this, it seems good to exclude him from the Lord's Supper and to send him to the city council on Monday, so that the council could take whatever action it deems appropriate to repair this scandal. But they add, at the end, the consistory asks the council to please consider the fact that he came willingly to confess his fault. And here, I think that's an interesting example of the sort of appreciation that the consistory might demonstrate, right? When someone has actually sort of followed the plan, has looked inside themselves, has realized the error of their own ways, and has brought themselves forward That was the ideal, right? For people to bring themselves forward. But it is not that common. All right, the second category and the last example that I want to give to you so we can turn the lights back on is a case of servants getting caught in the situation of having to report on their masters. And this is where there are some cases with servants where you see sort of the pressure from the consistory to tell the truth, and sometimes pressure from the employers to not tell the truth. One case where this is very explicit is a case of a servant named Jean, who works for the Chapeau Rouge family. And Jean is the star witness of the consistory's investigation into an alleged affair between her mistress, a woman named Etienne, and a man named Jean Claret, who is a visitor at their house and seemed to spend a lot of time there, and through parties at the local Genevan bathhouse, which was also something that was not a place that was not a big favorite of Calvin or the consistory. Many people seem to have known that Claret very likely was having an affair with this married woman. There are many rumors. Many different witnesses get called. Relatives and neighbors get called to the consistory to explain what they know. But the key piece of information, the one person who can really tell the consistory, yes, adultery was committed, is this one servant named Jeanne. And finally, she appears before the consistory, and the consistory is very skeptical. At one point, they say they think that she's been lying about some of her testimony. And as they go on to question her, they ask her what she knows about Claret and her mistress. And at one point they say, well, what did, you know, did Claret talk to you? Did he try to get you to not talk to us? And she sort of hems and haws a little bit. She talks about the gifts that he gave her. She doesn't actually say bribe, but she says, oh, he gave me a box of hairpins. And then finally she says, and he told me not to tell the consistory, right? He told me specifically not to tell the consistory that I had given, or that my mistress had given him the key to our house so that he could let himself in. And the consistory said, okay, did anyone else tell you not to tell us the truth? And Jen said, well, yes, my mistress said that probably the consistory was going to call me to ask about this relationship. And I told her, well, it's not because of me. I didn't tell anyone anything. It's probably because other people know. And the mistress said, you may not tell them that I gave Jacques Claret this key and that he slept at our house. Obviously, we know this because Jeanne did, in fact, tell the consistory. Right? So something that is curious about that case and frustrating about consistory records is that we don't know for sure why Jeanne made that decision. But we do know very clearly that there is pressure on her not to tell the truth. Right? There's pressure on her to conceal the truth from the consistory in order to protect her mistress's reputation. Very briefly, two other examples. There is a case a little bit earlier where the consistory calls two female servants before them because these female servants have been fighting. And it turns out that what the argument is about is that the mistress of one of them, her name was Louise de Creux, had been having apparently a variety of affairs. And the second servant had said to the first servant, you are just avoiding knowing about this, right? You're sort of avoiding knowing the truth by staying home. You are staying home just so that you won't know that your mistress is having an affair. And the servant of Louise de Creux says sort of proudly to the consistory, and so I told her that she was a whore, and I protected my mistress's honor. It was very clear to the servant that she had done her job, right? She had defended the other servant's attack on her mistress. She had asserted there was nothing going on and had defended her mistress's honor. The consistory's response was, in the future, you should be careful that you are not so concerned about the honor of your mistress that you forget about the honor of God. Right? You should not be putting the honor of your mistress above the honor of God. They do not take any further... something that's interesting here is that they don't take any further disciplinary action against that servant. Right? What they do is chastise her to do better next time. But they don't excommunicate her or anything like that. So there's some play here, right? Some recognition sometimes of the difficult situations that servants could be caught in. A last one, just not to leave you with the idea that this is only women who could get caught in this situation. There is a case in 1550 of a minister going to the house of a man named Jean Navetta. And the minister is going there because Jean Navetta is accused of blasphemy and accused of insulting the ministers. And the minister arrives at Jean Navetta's house and asks his servant if he is home. And the servant says, no, he's not here. You'll have to come back another time. And as it turned out, he was there, and he just didn't feel like seeing the minister. So the servant and Jean Navetta get called before the consistory, and the consistory says, did your servant lie for you? And Jean Navetta says, yes, and he did his job well. Because he did his job well because I like to, when I am eating, I like to be at ease. I don't want to be bothered by the ministers. And in this case, that master is disciplined, right, for blaspheming and for not running a good household and for a variety of other issues. All of these different cases, right, I'm not at a point where I can give you a final conclusion on sort of the interplay between family obligations and Catholic connections and struggles with the consistory. But what just these few examples, I hope, give you a flavor of is the fact that on a regular, the regular basis of their meetings, Calvin and the consistory clearly had their ideal that they were working towards. And clearly they were frustrated by the ways that people didn't live up to those ideals, but they were also working with these problems, right? There's a pragmatic aspect to the consistory. And let me leave you with Calvin's final remarks to the city council, right? Calvin's final remarks to the company of pastors are famous when he tells them, change nothing, right? People always ask for change, but change is dangerous. Change nothing. Right before that, I think the day before that, he had spoken to the city council. And what he says to the city council is much more, gives us much more the idea that Geneva is still a work in progress for Calvin. He says to them, some magistrates are cold, given over to their private business, and seldom serving the public. Others are abandoned to their passions. Others, to whom God has given a prudent spirit, do not use it. Others are opinionated and wish to acquire undue credit and reputation. I am about to die, and there are still a lot of problems here. May the old not envy the young any graces they have received, and may the young modestly content themselves without wishing to advance too rapidly. We should not become discouraged, nor get in one another's way. When annoyed, we should not give rein to our passions. Everyone should work according to his station and faithfully employ whatever God has given him in order to maintain this republic. The consistory is not meeting out the civil justice of the republic, but in many ways, those last few sentences, I think, sum up what the consistory is doing, or at least part of what the consistory is doing by the time that Calvin dies. Right, the consistory is in a sort of constant, exerting constant effort to teach people not to get in one another's way, right? To not be discouraged about the frustrations, especially to try to teach people to not give rein to their passions. But it is not something that ever comes to a final conclusion during the life of Calvin. I'm going to stop.
Well, now Karen can feel like she's back in class because now we get the chance for questions. Paul's going to switch the lights on. There you go. Wonderful. Thank you. So I found this absolutely fascinating. And I think the work of the consistory is the patience that they demonstrated with some of these cases, seeing people again and again and again. And they're not really a law court. I mean, they don't have the function of a law court in that way. They're really meeting weekly in an ongoing effort. Sometimes it must have been terribly frustrating to try and get these people to acknowledge what they've done, and they do weigh witnesses against each other and so on. So I was wondering if you could say anything. I don't know if you have any cases where it's a pastor who's gotten into trouble, and he is also sort of charged with not telling the truth about what's going on. Is that something that they would be particularly concerned about seeing in a pastor as a flaw? Because there are pastors who get into trouble for various reasons. I was wondering if that was something that you had come across at all, where a pastor is really asked to live up to these standards of truth-telling and to see how far that person has fallen short?
That is a great question, and I have not seen those cases yet. But as I said, I haven't, on this particular topic, I haven't yet looked at every single case in the consistory. One factor that might condition that is that I think that those concerns would first be addressed through the company of pastors, right? And that sort of one-on-one admonishing. But yes, I think that is an excellent hypothesis. Although in the end, I'm not sure that they would certainly be equally concerned, right, for pastors. I'm not sure that they would be more concerned than anyone else telling the truth. But I will look for that.
Okay. Questions, comments, things you want to add? Yes?
In other parts of the Europe, were there comparable bodies that were trying to police the morals of society? And this wasn't unique.
Right, absolutely. Certainly in other areas that where there were Reformed churches, there were consistories. So there are consistories with the French Protestant churches. The Scottish Kirk has these Kirk sessions that act as consistories. But that idea of the consistory is something that has become sort of associated with Calvin and Reformed Protestants. And in fact, there's a trend in the 1500s towards social discipline more generally. So, for example, one example that I was just talking to my Reformation class about, the city of Augsburg becomes fully Protestant in 1537. It's Lutheran, right? That is not a Calvinist city. And in 1537, the government establishes a disciplinary, it's not exactly a court, but a disciplinary body that has a lot of very similar concerns about sort of the morality of social behavior. So, yes, there are comparable bodies in other places, and depending on the religious situation, sometimes those bodies are actually more controlled by local governments than by churches themselves.
Yes.
Yes, sir. A little bit more about that. I'm interested in the relationship between the consistory and the council and how they work together or didn't work together. What's the process?
Okay, and they do both, absolutely. So the consistory, those 12 elders that are on the consistory are also members of the city council, and the main moderator of the consistory was always one of the four syndics, the four heads of the Genevan government. So the city council always is part of the consistory, even though that they are there as church members, right? Not as government officials. For the consistory would, if through a consistory examination or investigation, they discover that someone had committed adultery, for example, or committed something else that was a civil crime, they would pass that person on to the city council. So that's a very clear relationship. There are many other examples where the consistory is going to the city council and saying, please, please won't you put this into legislation. One famous example of that in the 1550s is when, in the late 1540s, is when Calvin and the pastors and then the consistory decide that there needs to be a naming ordinance, a list of names that are prohibited in Geneva, and they can't put that into law, right? They need the city government to do that. So they have to go, Calvin himself goes several different times and makes the argument for why this should be put into law, and eventually it does get put into law, but it can be a slow process. So I think that they were always interacting closely, and it depended very much on the situation whether they were fully cooperative or whether they were acting with different priorities.
Yes, sir.
Is there any typical punishment for adultery? And any difference between men and women adultery?
There was one of the unusual things for the time about Geneva was that men are punished for adultery more substantially than they are in other places. And I am not off the top of my head recalling the exact punishment. Ray, do you know the punishments in Geneva?
A great deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are a variety.
So part of it is it the first offense?
Yeah.
Is it a repeated offense? Okay. The more likely it is that it's a repeat offense, the more severe the punishment is likely to be. On paper, the laws and sometimes are draconian, along the lines of you will be killed if you commit adultery. But in practice, that almost never happens. Because generally speaking, there is some forgiveness of the other partner in the marriage, is willing to forgive the person, or something else happens. So although on paper, again, it's one of these things, on paper you think, wow, that's strict. In reality, that's not what's going around. I have rarely seen a case where there's actually any kind of execution happening.
Right, absolutely.
But being imprisoned on bread and water for a while, three days, 10 days on bread and water, a fine.
A significant fine.
Exile if it's a repeated behavior. They have one woman who has essentially a mental disorder, and she thinks everybody is her husband. Every man she meets is her potential husband. And this gets to be very difficult. But the consistory, what do you think? I mean, the consistory finally decides that she's not sane, basically. And they basically...
How long did it take for
them? it's a very famous case. Bob Kingdon wrote about it. The case of Amou is the last name. Bernadette Amou, I think. Anyhow. It gets just to be bizarre. Mm-hmm. I mean, she thinks Calvin is in love with her, and it's just a big, big mess.
It's also more complicated if there's a child involved, or if there's a pregnancy, and if the woman is married and there's a pregnancy, it depends a lot on how her husband reacts to the situation. You know, if her husband is sort of willing to accept the child and help cover it up, that's a different issue. If her husband rejects the child, then that makes the situation much worse in the eyes of the officials.
Yes, Darren.
On this issue of truth telling, do you see any changes over time from like the early 1540s to late 1550s, just in terms of frequency or the kinds of cases? In other words, are they having success? Like, are they having success in getting people
more truth? I think, you know, I think what the consistory has the greatest success in those 20 years is getting people to learn the Lord's Prayer and learn the Ten Commandments and being able to say their statement of faith. I think the consistory has somewhat less success in actually changing the daily behavior of people. And one of the areas that I don't so far see a lot of change is in this issue of sort of family priorities and protecting family reputation. So that's you know, that there's partly a problem of sources, right? The families that agree with what the consistory say and try to live their lives transparently are less likely to show up before the consistory. So, you know, I can't say for sure over the whole population that that hasn't improved. But I can say that it continues to be a problem in the consistory records.
Yes, Paul.
It seems clear that the consistory expected servants to testify against their master and mistress. Did they also expect spouses to testify against each other? Did they expect self-incriminations?
Well, what they hoped for was self-incrimination, right?
Voluntary things were things.
Right, exactly. And that was a pretty standard court expectation across Europe at that time, that sort of the most concrete proof was admission of guilt. So both sort of theologically speaking and practically speaking, what they always hoped for was admission and self-incrimination. But in terms of who they would expect to provide information, yes, it went across the board. So servants theoretically were in a situation where they could be pressured more by both sides, right? But the consistory would certainly question. They would question spouses. In some cases, they would question children. They would certainly question neighbors or parents. Right, so anyone who knows that the person who is involved may be called, you know, those interrogations may be more or less productive, but they're usually going to happen.
Let's see, at the back first, then
how long did that consistory persist after Tony's
death? It persists through there's some form of the consistory today, I think.
Yes.
In the Genuine Church.
Yeah.
How long it is so influential through the 1600s. So there's a phase after Calvin dies when Theodore de Beze is the head of the church in Geneva, and the consistory is sort of increasingly powerful for several decades. There's a time in the early 16-teens and 1620s where there are some cases where they start to back down. For example, for a long time after the death of Calvin, parents have been asking, what I know, of course, is baptism examples. Parents have been asking, well, could we please not have to keep the baby if it's winter and it's cold and the baby's going to get sick? Does the baby really have to stay for the sermon at the baptism? And they've been saying, yes, 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 Calvin told us not to change anything. Yes, 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 the sermon is important. And then there comes a time in the sort of 1620s where they back down on that. But really, you know, certainly through the 1600s, this is still a highly functional body.
Wayne?
How many people left town to become Catholics? Today, people just would cut and run. Wherever they thought they were comfortable.
Right. Well, part of what I find really interesting is that not everybody left, even though they clearly didn't want to live by every rule of the consistory, right? That there are people who choose to stay in Geneva, who see themselves as Genevans, who will officially convert to Protestantism. And there's always this question of how many people were secretly Catholic, which is difficult to know because it was secret. But again, problem of sources. But I think there's also a question of for how many people going to church was going to church, right? And going to church when they went to Lyon and were visiting their Catholic relatives was going to church, and going to church in Geneva was going to church. And people are seldom willing to say that to the consistory itself. But the biggest, to answer your specific question, the biggest outpouring of Catholics is right around the time of independence in Geneva, when the city becomes independent and officially becomes Protestant and closes the local convent, and sort of the bishop by then has and his whole household have left. So that is when we really see the biggest emigration of Catholics, and it's interesting that we don't see a big one after that.
The question was, this unique somewhat to Geneva and the whole Calvinistic movement? I mean, what did the Lutherans do? What did the Zwinglis do? What did all the other reformers do?
In terms of what?
Of a consistory or that model of church government.
The specific form of the consistory and the body of that the elders and the pastors working together, that is modeled on Calvin himself. But that the idea of, as I think I was saying earlier, in other places, there's still this idea of enforcing social discipline, and the question is how much of it falls on the church and how much, in some case, how much of that falls on city government.
Mm-hmm. There was no separation of church and state.
Not the way we think of it today, exactly.
But just to embellish that question a little bit, the work of the consistory sounds to us in the 21st century kind of inquisitorial.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a richly pastoral dimension to it.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, to you as a 16th century scholar, is the Genevan approach more pastoral than the Lutheran approach or the inquisitorial approach of Catholicism or of the confessional with its imposed penance? How do you, is there more humanity in the Genevan approach than in some of these others? I mean, Zwingli drowned the Anabaptists in the river. So I'd like to hear your reflections.
Let me start by saying that Geneva was also not a good place to be an Anabaptist. So I don't want to make Calvin out to be soft and mushy. I think the easiest comparison is the Inquisition. Right, I think that the consistory is very definitely more pastoral. There's the term that people like Robert Kingdon and Ray Mentor have used, that the consistory is more of a morals court, or even almost a, in some cases, Kingdon described it as a sort of counseling service, right? There's a big emphasis on pastoral counseling. And the role of the Inquisition is about heresy, right? The Inquisition also was not always as harsh as its reputation has become. And there's also, the Inquisition also put a lot of effort into sort of encouraging and teaching people to recant and bringing people back into Catholicism and away from heresy. So there's that pastoral aspect to the Inquisition. But in terms of sort of behavior in daily lives and interpersonal relationships, I think the consistory is certainly more pastoral than the Inquisition. And it's an interesting comparison to confession, right? Because what if you're looking for someone to sort of give the self-proclamation of what they've done, the consistory is much more public than the confessional. They're looking for a public confession. They're looking for public, in some cases, public reparations. At minimum, reconciliation in front of the consistory itself. Whether being more public about that is also being more pastoral is a little bit more of a complicated question.
I think we'll take one final question. Yes.
thank you, Art, for your presentation. My question comes out of personal experience. I retired teaching at Calvin in 99, and since that, my wife and I have been teaching at Peking University, and several things, having studied Calvin before that, several things have come to my mind or that I've been playing with. I wonder if we can also contextualize Calvin more fully by seeing him as a very Western product in contrast to the East. And this whole accent on truth in the West has been coordinated in the East, certainly the China that we know, by harmony, accent on harmony. You have words and propositions in the West, you have acts and gestures strong in the East. You have low context culture in the West, you have high context culture in the East. You have submission to rules and laws in the West. You have submission to hierarchy in the East, certainly China. You have a strong accent on guilt in especially Western theology, particularly Protestant. You have a strong accent on shame in China. Background in the West is Greco-Roman, Hebraic, Christian, and in the East is mainly Buddhism and Confucianism. It struck me several times in reading the the anecdotes of Confucius that he, for example, would have a student come to him and say, there's so much integrity in my town. We have a father who committed a crime and his son reported him to the authorities. And Confucius replies, that's not true piety. In my city, the ideal situation is that when a father does something wrong, his son covers up for him.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very strong indeed in the East. I'm not suggesting that one is better than the other, but our students at Peking University, if you press them, would say cheating in itself is not so wrong. What's wrong is the shame that comes in getting caught. Mm-hmm. Now, my question is, to your knowledge, is there any scholarship trying to ferret out more fully how much John Calvin himself is a product of a Western worldview?
Well, I think there's probably no question that Calvin himself is a product of a Western view. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think certainly that education that he received, right, that the whole form of Christianity that he is contributing to, right, is very much the Western tradition at that point. And as much as he and other reformers are seen as revolutionaries in some way, right, they are steeped in Western Christian theology and Western Christian teaching. So I think, yes, not only, you know, looking back, did Calvin become part of creating Western culture, right, but I do think that it is fair to say and accurate to say that he is part of a particular intellectual and religious tradition, and even philosophical tradition that developed specifically in the West. The other thing I think is interesting, listening to the comparisons that you're making, is that some of the people who come before the consistory, right, are not acting on what we now see as traditional. If the list that you gave us is sort of the traditional Western priorities, people are coming before the consistory and saying, this would be shameful for my, right? This would be shameful for people to think this about my family. That's why I didn't want to tell you. And so, you know, an interesting question for social and cultural historians is, how does the sort of culture on the ground compare with that written intellectual tradition that Calvin is very definitely part of?
Well, that's a very good stopping point, I think. Please join me in thanking. I believe the main exits of the library are still open, but you'll have to go down to two floors. The third floor entrance is definitely closed at 5 o'clock. So if you want to chat about anything, ask any questions independently, feel free. And otherwise, thank you for coming, and we hope to see many of you again tomorrow. Thank you.